This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah wa salatu wa salamu ala Rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa mawala wa ba'du. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. To all our guests, our visitors, our viewers and our listeners, and of course to my co-host this evening, Dr. Maulana Yusuf Patel. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Maulana, thank you for having me.
No, barakallahu feek. I'm really happy that you joined me on this podcast. And of course, let us not delay and bring on our guest of honor this evening, inshallah. None other than Dr. Jonathan A.C. Brown. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you doing?
It's so lovely to have you, and thank you so much for agreeing to join us in the podcast.
My
it's
pleasure.
An honor. Alhamdulillah.
Nice compliment to me to be in it, so I'm happy to do it.
Oh, no. I think the honor is ours, really. I've known you for a couple of years now, alhamdulillah. I'm happy to call you teacher. I remember the first time walking into a lecture hall, a small little lecture room, and we were going to learn this course on hadith with this book, Hadith, Muhammad's Legacy in the Medieval and Modern World. And I'm reading the book and I'm thinking, okay, it's written by Jonathan Brown. Like, where do you get the Jonathan Brown who writes a book on hadith, Muhammad's Legacy in the Medieval and Modern World? And I was just expecting to get this whole Ignaz Goldsier, Joseph Schacht, you know, type of thing. And then as I read the book, I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then I met Dr. Brown, alhamdulillah. And also I have a sanad that goes through, you know, haddathana, Sheikh Jonathan Brown, qala haddathana. In fact, we had so many requests for you to narrate that hadith, al-musalsal bil-awwaliyya. There are many of our colleagues and teachers there who didn't have that opportunity the last time. And they said, you know what, you have to ask him to tell us about his isnad and his mashayikh and his studies in the traditional world. So over to you, Dr. Brown, what do you have to say about that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I don't know. It's sort of silly. I mean, it's not a silly request. It's silly for people like you. I mean, you all have done so much more study than me that I don't know why you would. No, it's true. It's not like a matter of interpretation. It's factual. I mean, I wouldn't even like pretend to have gone through the kind of studies you've gone through to. I mean, I just have a different perspective, and that may be like I ask different questions, I try to explain in a different way, and so it can be useful, but, you know, I don't think that anything in that book is something that is, you know, is an insight that you're not going to find in the Islamic tradition. It's just sort of organized differently. Although it's
presented really well for a Western audience as well. Like really taking, doing a good job of presenting the tradition in the English format to a Western audience and telling the story of hadith really, as opposed to, you know, normally what we tend to do when trying to present hadith is or at least I did in the past, basically just try and convey mustalah al-hadith, which is like a whole lot of terminology. And when people start hearing all those terminologies, then they just get completely turned away from hadith because it's just like, no, this thing is just too complicated and, you know, it's not for me. And then they leave it. But the way you've laid it out in that book in particular, which is what really got me into your articles and your books and so on, it was somewhat different, right, Dr. Yusuf?
Yeah, definitely. And let me state here, Dr. Brown, Maulana Irshad was my teacher at the madrasa when I came into third year. And so you taught us hadith. And I remember, you know, obviously studying Mustalah and various other of the sciences within Hadith. But every lecture, we got an article from your respected self. We were asked to read the book. And again, I mean, definitely you'll benefit by reading the classical texts like Nukhba and so forth. But personally for me, and I'm sure for the other students in the class and in the madrasa, was that your works augmented what we studied. And I think that's important, especially from an academic perspective, being able to articulate certain points. Because usually students at, you know, madrasas, they tend to remain within a cocoon and within a sort of a traditional shell. And they're not really aware of the studies that are going on within the academic centers, the valuable studies, yeah.
So who's your inspiration? I mean, this was surely like uncharted territory for you. Where did you draw from, you know, in terms of presenting the traditional sciences in this format? What was your, you know, guru in this field?
Well, it was, by the way, it was funny because I think that class that I taught that year in South Africa, it was, I walked in and they were recording the lecture by, they had an iPad leaning on, sitting on a pile of my books and leaning on a pile of my books and then looking at me. It was just sort of this incredibly narcissistic image of just like lecturing on something and being recorded on a pile of my own books, which is funny. I think I still have a picture of that. But yeah, I mean, I think for me, it was, I think I was really influenced by two general trends, I mean, or strains. One would be reading the books of Muhammad Abu Zahra, Sheikh Muhammad Abu Zahra, rahimahullah. I think he died in 1974, Egyptian Azhari scholar who wrote a volume on each of the four imams. He wrote one on Ja'far al-Sadiq. He wrote one on Ibn Hazm. He wrote one on Ibn Taymiyyah. And then, but he really looked at each of these figures and kind of explained how like Malik or Abu Hanifa was trying to, they were all trying to accomplish the same task, right? And so he would kind of look at their perspective and he wasn't judging them or, you know, trying to, you know, engaging in kind of polemics. It was really trying to understand like, what was this person trying to do and why did that lead them to make this choice and that choice? And then I realized that he was drawing a lot on Shah Wali Allah, Rahimahullah, the great Indian scholar, died 1762 Miladi. And so I went and I read his books, especially his Al-Insaf, he has Bab al-Ikhtilaf, his Hujjat al-Allah al-Baligha. And I saw kind of the same approach where he's really looking at all these madhhabs or all these schools of thought as kind of perspectives on one approach. They're all kind of trying to do the same thing. They have different priorities. They have different anxieties, or they have the same anxieties, but different ways of addressing those anxieties. By anxiety here, I don't mean like some kind of teenage thing where you, you know, walk in just where you don't have your pants on or something. I mean, like they're worried about misrepresenting the Prophet's words, they're worried about misunderstanding their religion. They're worried about corrupting it. They're also worried that people won't understand it. They have these anxieties, you know, whether it's like the Mu'tazila or, you know, Ahmad ibn Hanbal, rahimahumallah, they all have the same concern, right? They want to understand their religion correctly. They don't want to corrupt it. They don't want to misrepresent it. They want to understand what aspects of it are kind of eternal and unchanging, what aspects of it are changed with circumstance. And, you know, although they might sometimes oppose each other bitterly on some particular issues, they're all motivated by the same approach. And I think that seeing that, like, and when you look at history like that and Islamic thought like that, it stops being this, as you said, sort of like a dry and almost academic examination. And it really, you go back and live, like, you put yourself in the shoes of those early community, early community. And like, as the generations move on, you can like almost kind of relive that experience of like trying to address these challenges. And as time goes on, as you move geographically and temporally away from Arabia. And so that was really like to try and go back and see, show how the Hadith tradition emerged, not as some kind of dry academic or obscure science, but actually as a very common sense way of trying to preserve information and trying to sort through claims people are making and how do you know which ones are correct, which ones aren't. And then, so that was one way. And the other way was through what, you know, what people who study Hadith today would talk about is like, you know, Manhaj al-Mutaqaddimin. And I got this from some of my teachers in Cairo. And especially, they turned me on to the books of Sheikh Hamza Millibari in the UAE, and he's an Indian scholar. And I read his books, and I eventually actually met him. It was really nice to meet him in person. But you know, where that approach also kind of goes back and says, like these mustalahat, they don't really work very well. I mean, which is true. That, I mean, this is in some ways, it's a mustalahat is a useful way of learning about things, but it's not that useful, right? Because you say like, oh, munkar means this, and then you go and read a book, and that guy doesn't mean that by munkar.
It's very little practical application to understanding the story of hadith in that sense.
Yeah, so you don't, you always have to know what a certain person means by a term, because that they don't follow these books that are going to come, that they didn't know were going to come centuries after they died. And so I think that approach really also is very common sense. That, so those two, I think those two perspectives really important.
It's quite interesting that I think, and this is maybe why I was so, taken by your work, especially when I read Misquoting Muhammad and your fascination with Shah Waliullah. And our own teacher, the late Mawlana Taha Rahimahullah, who we sadly lost, may Allah grant him Jannah, he was also, he was very fond of the works of Shah Waliullah, and we read many of his works. Iqtul Jid, Hujjatul al-Baligha was actually one of the works in the final year, to study it in the final year once upon a time, and Al-Insaf as well. But it was more of the accomplishments and the revival of hadith and his approach that was that really stood out, and it's quite evident in your works as well. And subhanAllah, it was quite a, for us it was like, yeah, we have a rock star in the field of academia who's representing the tradition. I think that's how many of us felt. I mean, of course, I can't speak for everyone. That's at least how I felt. And alhamdulillah, and and when I met you, it was like, wow, not only is he a rock star in terms of his... and subhanAllah, I know you've spoken about that.
I mean, I think... I was really sad to hear about Mawlana Taha Kiran's passing. I was really, I met him, I think, in Cape Town, and I thought he was a really interesting person. I mean, he was very open-minded. He was very, quote unquote conservative, but also very open-minded, which I thought was a really impressive, disposition to have. And, I think maybe if I've contributed anything, it's to sort of just show that you can be, a Muslim who's really proud of their tradition and be an academic in the West. I'm not sure that's a big accomplishment, but I mean, I don't see those things as intention. I mean, I see the Islamic tradition as a tradition of academic excellence, which is the same thing in theory that I'm supposed to be pursuing as a professor or as a writer or researcher. And I don't see these things as in any way in any kind of in conflict at all. I mean, I see. And so I think that trying to kind of reveal that the idea that these are supposed to be in conflict, to reveal this as an illusion, has been one of my main objectives. Of course, there's disagreements or incompatibilities, but those are not inherent in those two kind of traditions, right? So if you say, well, you have to be secular to be an academic, I don't know who said that. I mean, why is that the case? I mean,
that is a perception.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a perception. I think more so in the past, that dichotomy of secular and sacred always plays out. And, sadly so, I suppose, in the madrasa systems, if we want to be honest about it, it does play out there because there's this historical baggage, not to blame the students or to blame the structures, but I think it's something that needs to be looked, to be ameliorated. And again, I think it's these type of works, these type of engagements, finding that common ground between scholars like yourself, scholars within the traditional settings, sharing platforms, speaking, engaging, working on shared projects. Those type of engagements definitely help. And I think it breaks that perception.
Absolutely. But how do you do it, Dr. Brown? Like seriously, we were just discussing this before we started, and we said, you know what? This man, mashallah, is producing like really amazing works. And yet, you're active in Facebook. whenever we hear from you, you're always commenting about some movie or something of the sort.
Food.
And yet the works that you produce, like, where do you find the time to accomplish what you're doing? This is no ordinary feat. This is your latest, your largest, or rather your latest large publication, Slavery and Islam. I haven't read the entire book yet, but, you know, mashallah, the way you tackled this topic, it's just a brave step.
Yeah. Even for me, this was interesting because I remember at the madrasa when I was, I think it was the fifth year, this topic came up in one of the classes. You know, we were discussing maqasid and so forth. And so slavery and Islam came up, and it was something that a lot of the students were, I wouldn't say battling with, but they were trying to understand in a bit more detail. And then a week later, you know, I just saw a message coming out that you'll be pursuing a book on the subject.
Right.
So it's really interesting how these things sort of spur.
Yeah. How do you do that, though?
I think that one way I was able to, I think, produce a lot of material was that I didn't get married till I was 32. I mean, I didn't. I mean, I basically
take note all the students out there.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of lived like a sort of like a, you know, hermetic existence, you know, for a long time.
Right.
I would sort of just, I would travel a lot to do research, to meet people, but I would, you know, I just sort of read and just researched and learned and studied and stuff for a long time. Maybe when other people would be busy with other things, you know, and I was just like obsessed, and I just did nothing but read and study and listen for years and years and years. So I think that's, and so when I started to write stuff, I had a lot of kind of research to draw on. Then the second thing was, you know, to know Muslim scholars who I could ask for help on things, who were, you know, able to direct me to sources that I wouldn't know about, or I wouldn't have thought of consulting. People like you, you know, people like you guys. you know, that was a big thing. I mean, a lot of what I've done is really just to take work of Muslim scholars and kind of translate it, not literally translate it, but kind of translate it conceptually or kind of shift it. Shift its presentation to, you know, a kind of English language, kind of secular facing medium. Those are two ways. I think this is, you know, people have some people have a kind of negative view of Muslim scholars, and they're all stupid and backward and stuff. And that's just a very unfortunate view. And I think that people who have that view, maybe they haven't really met enough impressive Muslim scholars. And I think when you do, or when you meet some, or when you, and then you read books of others, you know, you're just kind of, you know, blown away. I mean, I to this day, I don't think there's a day that goes by where I don't just like, just, I just can't, I'm just can't, man, I can't believe what these people do. I mean, it's sort of, you know, I have internet and word processing and search engines and all these indices we have, and just like keeping up with, let's say, the books that Dhahabi is citing or Ibn Hajar cite. I mean, you know, you have all these tools, and you're just using them to kind of keep up with what this other guy was doing.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't have any of these tools, you know. I mean, and that this was just like one of the massive multi-volume books that he wrote. Let alone, you know, you could. So I think that's. You know, my point is that there's people, you know, I don't think there's necessarily people like Ibn Hajar today. I mean, there's very rarely are there people like that. Someone like Kauthari was, or Imhullah, the Ghumari brothers were like that. But, you know, there are people like that today. I mean, there are certainly one or two, right? And if you can meet those people and learn from them, and then, you know, meet their students and learn from their students, and then have those people there to help you when you have a question, then you're going to be, you know, you're going to have an amazing guide through the things you want to study. And for me, it's always, there's always questions I want to answer. And they're not just sort of, I'm not trying to act like, you know, my questions are somehow important, but I mean, the questions I've found over the years are usually questions other people have, you know, that they're useful today. Questions. So, you know, like one set of articles I did was sort of on like Mets and criticism and how you can show that the early Muslim scholars are doing Met and criticism. And then you get to the question of like, okay, well, how do you get, is there a way to sort of get over the problem of subjectivity with Met and criticism? I mean, I don't think there is, but I also don't think that's necessarily a problem. I mean, that's not an impediment. It's just something to keep in mind. Another, you know, question I had is, okay, well, you know, Muslims have spent all this time authenticating material, but then they also, or at least some Muslims, use material that they know is not authentic. So why is that? Like, you know, so those are kind of questions I had. You know, questions about miracles, like, you know, Muslims are supposed to believe in miracles of saints. What does that mean? Does that mean have Muslims always agreed on that? I mean, I'm not even talking about bringing some kind of insane left field, progressive, right, you know, view or something. I'm saying like just within the Sunni tradition, what have been the views on this? And like, and you see that when Muslim scholars, like, you know, when they differ on these topics, their disagreements are really, really, not only are they kind of sent, they're very sensibly grounded disagreements, but they're the same disagreements that people would bring up today, right? So, you know, if you believe in miracles of saints, and if miracles of saints keep happening, then eventually miracles sort of lose their meaning, lose their importance, right? Or you know, people will end up kind of harming their relationships. They'll say like, well, this miracle happened, and so I'm going to leave my wife and, you know, go off and wander around in the wilderness or something. And, you know, some scholars are like, hey, you know, there's like a social cost to these things. So, I mean, I think that there's a, you know, when you explore these things, you realize that, you know, we tend to look back, you know, to look at these, you know, Muslim scholars, quote unquote, and say, you know, these guys are sort of, they don't have what it takes, and they never had what it takes to address modern problems. Like, they're always kind of lacking that capacity. And I think that what I find over and over again is quite the opposite. I feel like they are very aware of, because a lot of these problems are perennial problems. We think that they're new problems, but they're perennial problems. And they have addressed those. And when they disagree with each other, those are the same disagreements we have today, right? So you find that there's not really an objection you can bring up today, or some kind of concern you can bring up today, that some Muslim scholar in the past, some prominent Muslim scholar in the past, hasn't already looked at. And you probably has the same point you have, you know, and was making that, you know, 1,200 years ago or something. And and then, you know, just in terms of other things, like literally the questions that I have, like something about slavery or, those are, you know, these tend to be questions that a lot of Muslims have. And that's really like the Misquoting Muhammad book came out of that, of trying to sort of giving lectures and talks at mosques and Islamic centers. And then, you know, you just hear the same questions over and over again, and you realize that, you know, someone needs to. And then, of course, the writing I do for Yaqeen Institute, you know, a lot of that, those articles and essays are all on this, precisely these topics, you know, hudud, apostasy, you know, the Quran and Sunnah addressing men and women. That's really like, you know, I think those books are here to provide, I hope, very thorough and scholarly, but also accessible answers to these questions.
Oh, mashallah, job well done, right, Doc?
Yeah, definitely. Dr. Brown, what I wanted to ask, I mean, obviously many Muslim students, academics know that your PhD was on the canonization of Bukhari and Muslim, but what was your initial study years on in terms of your BA? Did you explore languages, or was it, did you immediately go into Islamic studies? What was your foundational years like?
When I was undergraduate, I was originally, I think, out of a Russian major. before I was Muslim. And then when I became Muslim, I just got interested in, you know, everything. I wanted to take any class that on anything to do with Islam or some world or Arabic. So I started to do that. And a lot of the classes were history, literature, things like that. And I took anything I could, and I just really got, I mean, again, I was trying to answer questions I had. I mean, how do I understand, how am I supposed to live as a Muslim in the United States? Like what does it mean to be Muslim in a place that's so different from where Muslims began? And in a lot of ways, that's the big question that everybody has.
That many people kind of miss as well. Like being Muslim in the United States is not like being Muslim in a predominantly Muslim country. It's quite different. The dynamic is different.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I think you're really lucky in a place like South Africa because you have both very strong Muslim community, but also a diverse, larger society you can be part of. So I think that's like a really good combination. In the U.S., the Muslim community is obviously a lot younger and established, and has spent the last 20 years, you know, as the object of immense scrutiny from the government and constant attack from kind of conservative groups, constant attack from liberal progressive groups. And that's taken a big toll on Muslims in this country, unfortunately. I think I studied that a lot. It was like history. But that really was kind of intellectual history, which is really sort of studying Islamic thought. And then I went to Cairo for a year and I studied Arabic and I did some sitting in like traditional study circles. But I didn't know Arabic well enough at the beginning to do that. But I met a lot of people where later on I would go and study with them. But then I went to grad school and I it's funny, I think if I could go back, I would have spent a lot more time studying in, you know, like a Muslim country and traditional studies. I did a good amount of that, but it was never like a systematic study.
So more informal.
I would say informal is I don't think you mean that as an insulting way, but I think like, informal, if you're doing one-on-one studies with somebody, that's informal, but it's also a hell of a lot more effective than sitting in a class with like 30 other people who are, you know, passing notes to each other and throwing paper or something like that. So, I mean, I think like, but it wasn't systematic in the sense that I didn't get, you know, this just kind of A to Z course of study, yeah, like all these different subjects. So, I mean, to this day, like people will ask me like, how do I do this? You know, Aqiqa, and I'll be like, I don't know. Like, how do I lead the funeral prayer? Like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I never learned about my religion, like Islamic studies, Islamic sciences as a way to like actually live my life. It was more like these intellectual topics.
Right. Interesting. So in terms of your traditional studies, Doc was asking about your academic studies, but in terms of your traditional studies, what was the most impactful or who was the most impactful teacher or what was the most impactful reading that really affected and impacted you in terms of the way you thought? I mean, you mentioned some of the scholars, but in terms of your own teachers and books that you read with them, was there anything that stands out?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, it's kind of unfortunate because the people that I really benefited from, I think, you know, I disagree with them significantly on, you know, some political issues, but I still really respect them as scholars. One of them, you know, one of them is Sheikh Ali Juma, the Egyptian scholar. And, you know, I got to know him when he was still relatively not famous. in the early 2000s, and I got a chance to study with him and read one full book with him, which was Fiqh al-Lugha by Al-Asnawi. Mm-hmm. And to hear some hadith books that he did commentary on. Just kind of being exposed to his way of thinking was really had a big impact on me. You know, it just showed me what it was like to be around a Muslim scholar who was really, you know, had the kind of gigahertz, the kind of mental capacity that somebody who is from like I don't want to say this as like an elitist way, but what I mean is that he could have been like anything in Egypt. He could have been a neurosurgeon or whatever, you know, and he decided to become an alim. And so to have somebody who brought together like hifdh and dhaka, you know, and ihatha, and to see that was just like, was really inspiring. And you realize like how impoverished one is if one just reads books, because the books are not to be they're not kind of guides, they're not living guides, they're sort of resources, and they're tools. It's when you see someone using the tools and you're like, oh, that's like, otherwise you'd be like, oh, I don't understand, like, this thing, this part of the book says X and this part of the book says not X. And that's a contradiction. And look, Muslims contradict themselves. And look at our heritage; it's all messed up. And so, and you realize like that's not the case. Like, these people were not idiots. They didn't just kind of, they weren't so stupid that they didn't. They mean, they wrote things and they understood that sometimes this thing was the tool used, sometimes that thing was the tool used, and that's completely fine for them. And so. And to see that, and to really be humbled over and over again by somebody, you know, when you ask a question, you think you've got somebody, and you know, and then they just sort of wipe the floor with you, and you're like, oh wow, it's really humbling for me. It was really humbling. And then some of his students, especially, there's a number of his students that I studied with that I really benefited from. But the one I think that I ended up studying the most with personally, and then. He really had a big influence on me was a scholar named Osama Sayyid Mahmoud Al-Azhari. I don't know why I forgot that, but he's only about a year older than me, or maybe a year or two older than me. But he was really, this guy was incredible. I mean, that's when you realize, you know, when someone has memorized like whole books and books and books, and then that's just like the data bank they're drawing on. And then they're also, you know, cognitively really capable, and to sit and read with them and to hear them reply to questions and is just kind of awe inspiring for me. And I think it would be for anybody. Like, I don't think I'm particularly, it's not like I'm insightful or kind of have low standards. I think anybody, intelligent or not, would be extremely impressed with this experience. So, I read a lot of books with him, but he would mostly sort of assign me books to read, and then I would come back and talk to him about and ask questions. So one thing I think that was like, I mean, I remember that really being kind of learning a lot from was reading the whole Mizan al-I'tidal of al-Dhahabi with him.
Whole thing.
Reading like the Muqaddimah of Sahih Muslim, reading Ilal al-Saghir of at-Tirmidhi, reading...
I did that with you.
Oh, really? Yeah, I hope it was. It's
very good. Very good.
And also reading like the first quarter of the Sunan of Ad-Darimi, which is, if anyone hasn't read that, I mean, if you're interested, I mean, it's a really fascinating, what is it? Abu Abdul Rahman, Abdullah bin Muhammad al-Dahrami, I think died 255 Hijri, about 878 or something, 860, I can't remember, 868. He's from near Samarkand, and he was kind of a scholar in the Shafi, not yet Shafi Madhab, but Shafi tradition. And his Sunan, I think it's the first about quarter of the book is sort of like an usul of the Ahl Hadith. It's sort of like an usul approach to interpretation and epistemology told through and constructed out of athar of the companion of the the prophet, on the companions, the successors, the sort of the first two or three generations. And it's really amazing. And sort of to read that with him was so I think that these kind of those experiences were formative for me. Mm.
Nice, yeah. For sure.
No, I think those are interesting points. Something definitely I think many of us experience as well with someone like Maulana Taha. Mm. I remember, I came from the medical field. I studied medicine first. And so when I was in med school, you know, you sort of had this grand picture of a professor when they present, you know, on the ward rounds. And that's something that you aspire to. And you're really impressed with the breadth of knowledge in terms of how they apply clinical medicine and studies and theory and so forth. But then, you know, when you meet people, as you mentioned, like Sheikh Ali Juma and so forth, you really get affected and influenced in terms of how scholars of the past and, as you mentioned as well, scholars today actually still hold that legacy up. Mm. I remember when I met Maulana Taha for the first time, I was just blown away in terms of his breadth. Like, you really appreciate this concept of when they say someone's an ocean of knowledge, like he's a bahar. It's an idiom used in English as well, but I really appreciated that, within the Islamic studies domain when I met someone like Maulana Taha. And I think it gives confidence to Muslims, you know, just to know that there is a tradition. A lot of people speak about reformation, and I think that has its place, definitely. But at the same time, you need to also understand that there is a tradition, and you cannot just do away with the tradition. And before you actually want to enter that domain, you need to know what the tradition actually talks about. You need to know the boundaries. You need to know what can be achieved within the tradition and the tools and instruments. So I found that really, influencing on me personally.
I know, absolutely.
Wait, hang on. Hey, guys, I got to run grab my power cord because my computer's going to die. I'll be back in 1 second. And it's out or whatever.
So I actually have a secret, right? So we started the Isnad Academy podcast and this channel, basically. And I did not delve into what an Isnad is or speak about it, because I was kind of saving that for the day that we got Dr. Jonathan Brown on so that he could explain it, because I felt that, it's such a central concept in our tradition. Mm-hmm. Like, from the Tabi'in, al-Isnadu min ad-Din, right? And it's so central that every single science that we have, every single discipline, whether that's hadith, tafsir, qira'ah, you name it, every science in the traditional world, you don't just pick up the book and read it, you get the Isnad. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what connects you to this legacy. Yeah. And you can see the impact that it has. People see, Dr. Brown, you know, this American scholar. Mm-hmm. But he's connected to scholars who essentially, you know, he even attaches himself to as part of this tradition. Mm-hmm. And this is traditional Islam. And for me, this is kind of just like what sets it apart. Mm-hmm. So now that he's back, we can stop speaking about him. Dr. Brown, I was just saying that we started this channel, right? We said we were not going to actually delve into this concept of Isnad. And I know many people were thinking, Isnad Academy, like, what's this about? But I was telling Dr. Patalia that it's such a central concept to the traditional world, you know, traditional Islam and its study, that every science comes through this Isnad. And I remember when I read it from your book on Hadith, I just felt that it was so beautifully explained, that it's not just this this chain of, you know, verification, a chain that you can verify authenticity with, but it has so much more than that. Would you care to share your thoughts on Isnad? Let's talk Isnad with Dr. Jonathan Brown. Bismillah.
And I guess, you know, I think, well, in one perspective, it's just, it's very obvious. And I think that we rob ourselves of a lot of benefit by not seeing that. So, you know, Shah Wali Allah, when he talks about knowledge, right? I mean, you either, and this is kind of a, again, this is not some profound insight he came up with. He's just kind of giving you a summary of how Muslims talk about, not just how Muslims, but how like Aristotle or St. Augustine would talk about the acquisition of knowledge. Like, and but here, I mean, knowledge, like literally just perception and idrak of the world around you, right? So you get things through perception or principles of reason, which are very few. Like sense perception obviously is a lot. But anything you haven't experienced, you get through a snap. Like whether it's someone telling you something or it's something you read or it's a video you watch, right? So everything getting by some kind of transmission that you, anything you haven't experienced is, comes by transmission. So in one sense, like you, to think about that and to think about like everything that you, if you want to verify the world that you are perceiving from outside your own experience, you have to be critical of that, right? Or you're not critical, but like you then just be honest about that, right? So like when I look on like the weather forecast and it says, you know, it's going to be cloudy today or something, like I don't think about that critically. Or when I hear that like my son's soccer practice is going to get moved to some other time, like I don't sort of be like, who's telling me this? I mean, so much of our lives, we just, you know, we kind of trust things because we're used to them, or it's not that important. If we're being misled, that we don't need necessarily have to. It's not going to cost us that much. But that when things are important, we do make a lot of effort to verify information. So that's one sense, like that thinking about Isnad as like the way that we learn or the way that we perceive the world around us is, I think, very important. Because that's how Muslim scholars thought about it, right? They thought about anything that you can't experience yourself or grasp through first principles of reason, you're going to have to get through some kind of chain. And then you should be aware of what that chain is and what its potential risks are. The second thing is, our traditions of knowledge to this day are still isnad based, even in the West, right? So, I mean, there's, when you go to like, you know, you could buy my book on Hadith and just read my book on Hadith. And that's like pretty much anything my classes, like I might give examples that are not in the book, but like, you know, everything I'm going to tell you is pretty much in the book. Same thing with my class. I've written so many books now. People could just read my books, like, or, you know, but why do you go to class to be with a teacher? Because you interact with them, they correct you, you ask them to specify, right? You learn to think critically, like they're teaching you how to think critically. Like one of my students asked me yesterday from one of my classes, like, you know, what am I supposed to learn in this class? And I said, actually, for this class, I don't really care if you learn anything, because this class is not really about you learning material. It's about you learning how to think critically, read critically, speak articulately, right? And so that's what you get from being around people who are more knowledgeable than you and more capable than you, or older than you, or more experienced than you. So the same tradition in our in any kind of place of education, any kind of traditional of education or practice, whether if they're like medicine, or I mean, how do you learn how to like cut a liver or to transfer a liver? I mean, you could read books on it, but you gotta basically, someone who's done that a lot, it's gonna teach you how to do it. Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing, and then finally, the last thing is just, you know, the idea of connection to the past, the idea of reliance on the past, the idea of being both a inheritor and a kind of a junior inheritor of a of something that's bigger than you and greater than you from people that were better than you and greater than you, but also having to rise to the occasion of that, right? So that you are now the face, you are now the latest, the edge of this, the leading edge of this, of this tradition as it moves into the present and future. And that you then have to step, you have to fill those shoes, even though you, you know, might not be as capable as you'd like to be. You have to fill those shoes. That's a big responsibility.
It's not your shoe size.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's like really important. And I think that, you know, I think that's very important.
Awesome. You know where this is leading today.
Yeah.
We're going to culminate into getting that isnad from Dr. Ranjal.
You know what I found interesting really in these in these recent times of COVID-19 is the application of hadith principles.
Yeah, we actually got a comment just a moment ago. In fact, we should actually look at the comments. I think it's exactly what you're about to say.
I'm just reading there. So basically that, as Tawhida Isaac says, even during the whole experience of COVID-19, isnad has been essential, but so easily discarded. And that's really just what I wanted to say as well in terms of the practical utility of hadith principles and the value of isnad with all this mass information not really being verified from sources, particularly on WhatsApp, emails. People are more confused than ever in terms of the authenticity and the value of what they're reading. And especially when it comes to, you know, something so serious as COVID-19, where so many people have passed away, so many people have become sick, have been impaired. It's important that we at least are able to draw on our tradition. Yes, I mean, it's not hadith proper in a sense of, you know, practicing the principles, but it's something that we could translate into our general daily activities and our daily affairs. I don't know what's your thoughts on that, Dr. Brown, with regard to the situation in the US. But yeah, that's what we've been experiencing here in South Africa. Yeah. A lot of criticism on misinformation and fake news.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, first of all, the idea that you verify information, you verify it by getting corroboration, you verify it by checking out who the source is, you assess the reliability of a source by their history of providing information, right? So it doesn't matter if I think, you know, Maulana Irshad is a nice guy or not. That just doesn't matter. Like, what matters is, have I consistently gotten reliable information from Maulana Irshad, right? Or does it matter that Maulana Irshad is a Hanafi or a Shafi or a Shiite or a Sunni, right? You know, that doesn't, like, that's the issue, is his performance. That people are very, you know, that somebody, you know, that you don't, like, trusting people's claims is just never a good idea, in the sense that, so, you know, Maulana Irshad come and say, like, oh, you know, I heard from this guy who I really trust this thing. And that guy's full of it. Like, you know, it doesn't, we don't get information just because somebody told me something and, you know, he says the guy's reliable. Like, which guy? Who is this person? You know, really, like, go and check, really. And then go and check, did that person really say this? Like, because Mirshad misunderstood the person, right? So go and check. I mean, I always remember this example in Allahumma sayyid Muhammad, I think it's in Al-Kindi's Tariqh al-Qudha, that, you know, that I think it's Bakar bin Qutayba, the Hanafi chief judge of Cairo in the kind of the time of Shafi, Imam Shafi wants to rebut Imam Shafi's, some of his opinions. But he doesn't just do that. He goes and he sends two, like, his reliable secretaries to go and attend, I think, Al-Muzani's class. And he says, did Shafi actually say this in this? And they listen to the whole book and then they check, did he say this thing? Yes, he said this. Then he comes, he gets the report back, and then he rebuts the opinions, right? He doesn't just say, like, I heard Shafi says this, and oh my God, I starts typing about, because maybe that's not what Shafi said. Maybe he never said that. Maybe somebody misunderstood him, right? So how much of our, you know, reaction to each other, or our reaction to information, or reaction to situations, is this based on this kind of off the cuff unverified, and that's not how Muslim scholars did things. Like, and it's they did that because they knew that the way that errors come into reasoning and to chains of transmission, and this is not just, I mean, we're talking about hadith, but this is like in any, that what I just gave you is an example from law, like whether it's law or theology or Sufi, anything. The methodology of the Isnad is permeates all Islamic sciences, right? Except, right, it doesn't. I remember, you know, there's this qaida, you know, ma kana, what is it? Ma kana ma'qulan fabfi wa la yuhtaju ila ta'arruf bi naqlihi, right? So whatever is ma'qul, its proof is inside it. It doesn't, you don't need to know, like if someone says 2 + 2 = 4, you don't need to be like, who said that? That person reliable? Like, where did you get that information? So if someone says, or a kind of critical point, right? So if someone says like, I'm trying to think of something from like COVID-19 or something. Like, you know, if, you know, someone says like, if you're immune compromised, it's more dangerous to get this disease.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't really like that. Just that's a basic kind of almost rational principle. Like if you lack the resistance of a regular person to X, then you are going to be more vulnerable to X than a regular person. Right. So that kind of thing is, but then, you know, you also have to be very careful about when you like, where that division between ma'qul and manqul is, because if someone says like, I am really nervous about COVID-19, so I'm going to wipe my groceries with Lysol wipes or something. And then, because you're thinking about kind of this, like you're getting a cold or something like that, but then you're thinking this is reasonable. And maybe it's a good precaution when you don't have access to information yet, but then you find out like, actually, this is transmitted sort of through inhalation and through air, right? So it's not like something you get like a cold where you're gonna touch something and then touch your eye or something like that, right? Like, so it's, sometimes we think that that a conclusion we come to is reasonable, whereas in fact we don't understand that it's actually not accessible to like first principles of reason, that it's actually a specialized subject of study. That so, for example, another example of this would be like improving healthcare reduces population growth. You're like, wait a second, what do you mean? If you have bad healthcare, more people die, that means there's less people. Okay, but if you look just sort of over time, how this actually functions in society, if you increase healthcare, people have less babies. Okay, I don't know why that is. It's just something like this, the specialized thing that people have observed who study that one area. And so, you know, a lot of times we get mixed up between, manqul, ma'qul. What's like ma'qul in the sense of awaliyat or badahiyat, like first principles of reason, versus what's actually what has come through nadhar, right? Nadhar. So if you nadhar and tajruba, so you have to have investigation and then empirical study before you can say that you can like rationally grasp certain things. So I think like our failure to kind of appreciate these categories, and of course then like that it doesn't matter who says certain things, like, you know, somebody go, why are you going to listen to that point, that guy's a bad person, or that guy's a Republican or a Democrat. Like that doesn't matter. And when you just don't listen to people because you don't agree with other things they say, then that's you're fundamentally misunderstanding how knowledge and truth.
We could do an entire podcast just on that last point. It's such a huge thing these days. I mean, with cancel culture, sort of flowing over into the traditional circles, all of a sudden, like, there's a scholar, you said one thing somewhere, you're willing to write off every single thing he's ever written because of that one statement that he said. Look, I've got one question from Qari Maulana Salim Gaby. He's one of the top scholars of Qira'a in South Africa. And he said, I need to ask this question. So in honor of one of our teachers, Maulana Salim Gaby wants to know, what's your advice to a student who, you know, wants to further their studies? Either they're just beginning as a student of deen, you know, studying Islam in traditional seminaries, etc., and they want to, you know, go further. Do you advise them to enter into academic studies in formal universities? And how should they approach that if you do?
Well, I think it depends, one, where you are. It depends what you want to do with it. I think, like, in a place, let's say you're in South Africa, I'm not sure who teaches in universities there, but I mean, it kind of depends, right? So in general, I would say be very careful of academia because, you know, I might not see any clash between, you know, being a Muslim in the Islamic tradition and being an academic, but most people do. And those people are not fans of the Muslim part of that, right? So in a lot of ways, yeah. And by the way, like people like Farid Issaq, this is why I think they, I mean, I don't want to speak for him, but I think he would agree with me. You know, I think one of the reasons they kind of got turned off by aspects of academia in the West is that they saw that a lot of kind of Islamic studies or discussions about Islam in the academy are essentially political projects, that they're created to sort of just suck in Muslims and just crush them spiritually, and then also kind of neuter them politically in a lot of ways. I tell Muslims, like, they don't take classes on Islam in universities, because the person who's been selected to teach for you is. And it's just, there's not like there's some conspiracy. There's not some committee of people who are like, I'm not saying that. Like, it's just the way that academia works. So in the United States, like, let's say, I don't know how things are in South Africa, but like in the United States, you know, you have, Muslims are a problem because this is how they're seen by the mainstream. They're a problem because they're a security threat. So we don't want them to get radical. And their problem because they're conservative and they don't have right views about gender and they don't conform to our culture, right? So the organs of that society, the infrastructure of that society, is going to work to break those things down, right? Yeah. So if you academia is full of people who are generally progressive, liberal, non-theists, right? And they are going to perpetuate those views and to push those views onto their students. Like, that's just the way it, and who's going to get the job? Like, who's going to get the job as an academic? Like, the guy who writes the book on how, you know, Islam says that actually homosexuality is great, or the guy who writes a book says Islam says homosexuality is prohibited. Who's going to get the job? Who's going to get the fellowship? Who's going to get, like our societies are built to produce and to encourage results that the power elite in those societies wants, right? And so they want liberal, progressive, depoliticized, unsure understandings of religion. That's what they want, right? And so that's what they'll, and you can see this, you know, if you read the 2007 Building Moderate Muslim Networks report that was produced by the RAND Corporation. Says we should go and promote, like, liberal, progressive Muslims and Sufis and, you know, Gulenists and stuff like that. That's what it literally says, this stuff, you know, and so it's not some kind of conspiracy. It's how a society's function. So I think that universities are organs in that system. And that doesn't, I love universities. I've never left university. This is not a criticism. This is just a sense of, like, you need to know what, if you want to go to university, go to university. that you're really going to benefit, things that you're going to be kind of put into a meat grinder over. Now, it depends. Like, if you can study with people who are not like that, right? So if someone can say, oh, I want to study with Jonathan Brown, well, I'm not going to be like that. You know, I'm not going to, at least in my classes, you're not going to be subjected to that kind of treatment. You know, it doesn't mean that I'm not going to try my best to make you a good scholar. I am, but it just means that, you know, the environment is very different. And so I think that it depends who you have the opportunity to study with. I would say that you should not, whatever you do, do not study Islam or anything about religion or philosophy, anything about kind of morality or knowledge without this very strong traditional grounding. You really have to know your stuff or you're going to get chewed up. And I've seen this happen more times than I can count. And now, I mean, I look at the kind of Muslims that I went into grad school in the same cohort, not just at my university, but all kind of across the board. And then ones who went in 10, 20, over the past 20 years. And I mean, it's been like, you can see like a few programs where you have professors who have like more kind of integrity as Muslims. Like they're producing, I think, really good Muslim scholars and good scholars, period. But a lot of the programs are just producing essentially not just people who have completely lost themselves to doubt and skepticism, but that are then committed to propagating that and sucking other people into that as well. And that's very disturbing and sad.
No.
It's sad. It's new and that we're not used to be like that.
Absolutely. I think it is a beautiful perspective. And I think many of our viewers who you know, inform me that they are waiting eagerly for this podcast, they'll appreciate that advice. Mm-hmm. And also many students currently and people who intend on, you know, pursuing the study of Islam. It's a big question because, I mean, there's real benefits to taking your studies further at university for whatever reason. But, you know, these are the concerns that they have. Dr. Brown, as we proceed to the end, I know we've had you on here for about an hour now. How do you feel about that request?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you can give, I mean, you can read in a snat, I guess, but I don't think you give ijazah over podcasts. I know people have written books on or written stuff on this.
We've done it.
My friend Garrett would probably know this, the answer to this. I mean, I'm sure that people have done fatwas on this topic. I mean, it's been so long since I should actually collect my snads into a book. I mean, it's not going to be like an award-winning book or anything, but it would be, I mean, and I have friends that have shorter snads than I do, but you know, I try my best. So I understand. What do you want? You just want me to like read an isnad for you? Is that the?
Yeah, I think the one in particular we were speaking about was the al hadith al musalsal bil awaliyah. If possible, you know, we don't want to really put you on the spot and pressure you into that.
I mean, I'm gonna read it to you because I'm not gonna say from memory because I haven't. I'm not confident that I wouldn't make a mistake, and there's no reason to make stupid mistakes.
Yeah,
no,
of course.
But it's not a short isnad, but it's a nice one. And there's other ones. Let me think. I can find some other ones. Maybe one second. This is from Bukhari. It's a snad to Bukhari, which is a pretty short snad. Okay. I'll do two, and then you can.
Bismillah.
I can just do two, and then you can. Again, it's sort of cheap to read, but otherwise, it's not going to be accurate. I don't feel comfortable. Okay. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Haddathani bihi Sheikh Sahab al-Abqari, Sheikh Osama Sayyid Mahmoud al-Azhari. قال وهو أول حديث سمعته من قال حدثني به الشيخنا الصالح المعمر بركة البركة أبو البركات محمد بن سعد بن بدران الدمياطي وهو الأول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا محمد بهاء الدين أبو ناصر القوقجي وهو أول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا أبي أبو المحاسن القوقجي وهو أول حديث سمعته من عن محمد عابد السندي the famous hadith scholar of the Hijaz, but originally from Sindh, obviously Muhammad Abid al-Sindi, who I will hadith sami'atu min, qala hadathni al-wajih Abdurrahman ibn Sulaiman al-Ahdal, who I will hadith sami'atu min. Now we've gone to the Ahadila in Zabid in Yemen, who I will hadith sami'atu min, qala hadathana Amrullah ibn Abd al-Khalik al-Mizjaji, the great Mizjaji clan, Hanafi scholars of Zabid, who I will hadith sami'atu min, qala hadathana Shamsuddin محمد بن أحمد بن عقيل المكي وهو أول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا أحمد بن محمد الدمياطي الشهير بابن عبد الغني وأول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا محمد بن عبد العزيز المنوفي بفتح الميم المنوفي المنوفية في مصر وهو أول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا أبو الخير عمر بن عموس الرشيدي هو أول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا شيخ الإسلام زهرية بن محمد الأنصاري الشافعي هو أول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا الإمام الحافظ أحمد بن علي الشهير بن حجر العسقلاني الكناني المصري هو أول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا الإمام عبد الرحيم بن الحسين العراقي الحافظ هو أول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا الإمام صدر الدين محمد ابن محمد ابن إبراهيم الميدومي الحنبلي وهو أول حديث سمعته من قال أخبرنا الإمام أبو النجيب ابن الصيقل الحراني وهو أول حديث سمعته من قال أخبرنا الإمام أبو الفرج عبد الرحمن ابن العلي الشهير بابن الجوزي الحنبلي البغدادي وهو الحديث سمعته من قال أخبرنا أحمد بن عبد الملك النيسابوري وهو أول حديث سمعته من قال أخبرنا والدي عبد الملك بن إسماعيل المؤذن النيسابوري وهو الحديث سمعته من قال أخبرنا الإمام أبو الطاهر محمد بن محمش الزيادي وأول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا الإمام أبو حامد أحمد بن محمد بن يحيى بن بلال البزاز وهو أول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا الإمام أبو بشر عبد الرحمن بن بشر بن الحكم العبدي وأول حديث سمعته من قال حدثنا أمير المؤمنين في الحديث سفيان بن عيينة وهو أول حديث سمعته من وإلى سفيان تنتهي الأولية على هذا المنوال قال حدثنا عمرو بن دينار عن أبي قابوس مولى سيدنا عبد الله بن عمرو بن العاص رضي الله تعالى عنهما عن سيدنا عبد الله بن عمرو بن العاص رضي الله تعالى عنهما قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم رحمهما ارحموا من في الأرض يرحمكم من في السماء وليرحمكم من في السماء رواه أحمد والحميدي في مسنديهما والبخاري في الكنى والأدب المفرد وأبو داود في سننه والترمذي في الجامع وقال حسن صحيح والحاكم في المستدرك وصححه وغيرهم وقال السخاوي إنه صحيح باعتبار ما له من متابعات وشواهد. And then the second hadith is the first hadith from Sahih Bukhari. أخبرنا الشيخ Muhammad ibn Israel al-Nadwi al-Salafi al-Mutawaffa sana 2900 miladi ijazatan qala akhbarana Abd al-Hakim al-Jaywari akhbarani Nadir al-Hussein qala akhbarana al-Shah Muhammad ibn Ishaq al-Shah Muhammad ibn Ishaq al-Dihlawi أخبرنا الشاه عبد العزيز بن ولي الله الدهلوي قال أخبرنا والدي سماعا إلى كتاب الحج مع إكمال باقيته على خلفائه أخبرنا أبو الطاهر الكوراني قال أخبرنا حسين العجيمي قال this is the the Ali, the Isnad Ali. قال أخبرنا محمد علاء الدين البابلي أخبرنا سالم بن محمد السنهوري قال أخبرنا نجم الدين الغيتي قال أخبرنا الشيخ الإسلام زكريا الأنصاري الشافعي قال أخبرنا أحمد بن علي بن حجر الأسقلاني سماعا لكله قال أخبرنا إبراهيم بن أحمد التنوخي البعلي وهو ابن رازين قال أخبرنا أحمد بن عبي طالب الحجار that is was illiterate but who remembered hearing Sahih Bukhari when he was a child in Damascus and then going out afterwards and playing in the canal with his friends who was later found to be the last surviving person from those hadith sessions أحمد بن عبد أبي طالب الحجار أخبرنا الحسين بن المبارك الحسين بن المبارك الزبيدي قال أخبرنا أبو الوقت السجزي الهروي قال أخبرنا عبد الرحمن بن مدن الداودي البوشنجي والفشنجي قال أخبرنا عبد الله بن أحمد بن حيوي السرخسي والسرخسي قال أخبرنا محمد بن يوسف ابن يوسف ابن مطر الفرابري قال تلميذ البخاري قال أخبرنا محمد بن سعيل البخاري قال حدثنا الحميدي عبد الله بن الزبير قال حدثنا سفيان قال حدثنا يحيى بن سعيد الأنصاري قال أخبرني محمد بن إبراهيم التيمي أنه قال سمعت علقمة بن ابن وقاص يقول سمعت عمر بن الخطاب على المنبر قال سمعت رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم يقول إنما الأعمال بالنيات وإنما لكل امرئ ما نوى فمن كانت هجرته إلى دنيا يصيبها أو إلى امرأة ينكحها فهجرته إلى ما هاجر إليه وعجزتكم بجميع ما روياتي حسب الشروط المعتبرة عند أهل العلم
Jazakumullah khairan. Dr. Brown, I thank you so much for your time. All of us, and we look forward to having you in South Africa again really soon. I know you love South Africa. And yeah. I know you love the people of South Africa. So we really, really need to get you here, please.
Yeah, I really want to come. You know, whenever you or whoever can manage to finagle an invitation for me. This time I want to try and bring my family. So, you know, bring my kids over.
Shall we'll get that sorted.
No, definitely.
You know, I mean, I'm not asking anyone to pay for them, but whatever, however much they can, you guys can chip away at the cost, I'd appreciate it.
Inshallah, we'll make a plan.
Dr. Brown, just a sideline question. Your favorite espionage movies? no, the reason why I asked this is that I had a debate today with a couple of friends after Juma regarding the Bourne trilogy or the set of the Bourne movies, the Bond movie that's also coming out now. So we're just discussing, you know, what would probably take the top few positions.
Like the best Bourne movie or the best like spy movie?
No, just in terms of. Just in terms of these espionage spy movies, like what would you rate, like as your personal preference? Obviously, do you enjoy the Bond?
Yeah, it was funny. Actually, I The Bourne movies, you know, the one I really liked was the Bourne Legacy, the one that doesn't have Matt Damon. It's not that I have anything. I just really liked the Bourne Legacy with Jeremy Renner. I thought that was really good.
Yeah.
It's funny because it's a bizarre circumstance, but I ended up talking to the director of some of the other Bourne movies.
Okay.
This is a very bizarre. I said, you know, I just want you to
just
know
knew which question to ask.
I like this other one the most, and he said, "Well, that's the one I like the least." I was like, oh, "Okay, well." Anyway, then I really liked Spy Game with Brad Pitt and Robert Redford. Okay, that was very good. It came out not long after 9/11, so it's an interesting kind of document of almost pre-9/11 film on espionage. I liked the Spy Game. I mean, I like all the James Bond movies, obviously. Mm-hmm. I liked my favorite James Bond is either Timothy Dalton or George Lazenby.
I did not expect Timothy Dalton.
Yeah,
oh, yeah I did Timothy not expect Dalton. That. He's got so much passion. You know, he's got a really passionate. You know, he's a. I like that. I think the Living Daylights is my favorite one.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Although GoldenEye is my close second.
I would have gone for Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah,
he's good.
I enjoyed watching Roger Moore. They're all good.
This is not to knock any of the other ones, but I think Timothy Dalton brought a kind of level of passion to the role that I hadn't seen. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, movies.
Not a Mission Impossible fan, eh? The Mission Impossible.
Yeah, I like Mission Impossible. Yeah. I like them. I like the Mission Impossible. I mean, the last one or two didn't blow me away. But I think I liked the one with Philip Seymour Hoffman. Mm-hmm. I liked. Of course, Mission Impossible is great. Yeah. And I think that's a good summary. I don't know how many.
Writing books like you do, then I'll start watching movies like you do.
Movies are interesting.
I almost never watch movies. Mm. On television. Like, I mean, I just, because especially I used to travel before COVID-19, I traveled a lot. So I would watch movies on the airplane.
Oh, I see.
That's what I do as well. I mean, just catch up on everything.
Yeah. So, I mean,
you can do.
Ever since I had kids and maybe even since I got married, my wife was trying to call me actually right now. I'm probably going to have to go in a second because.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, we've kept you.
But thanks for that. I think.
We really, really are looking forward to having you in South Africa. Like,
I would love to get you. You know what? Invite me. Sorry, I'm the point. Invite me and invite my wife because she can also give talks on lots
absolutely.
Of stuff. And we would love to come as a family.
We'll set something up. I'll speak to one of my good family friends, Professor Yasin Mohammed. I think he's with Yakin as well. And a few of our local academic centers, the library, Sound Academy. We'll work on something as soon as COVID allows, inshallah. We'll definitely.
I think it's allowed now, man. I think it's basically open.
We'll
work on something.
Everything is allowed now. But sort of like it's sort of a hard situation because you're like I'm supposed to go to Germany in a month or two, and I'm like, should I just go to Germany? I mean, actually, it's funny. I went to Turkey in the summer, and it was a lot less stressful than I thought. But it was also kind of before Delta stuff happened. So now I'm kind of am I supposed to? Should I do this or not? I don't know. I don't know what that. We'll hopefully we'll all know what to do in due time.
And you covered Dr. Brown because you know Dr. Yusuf Patel. He's actually a medical doctor. We'll sort you out, inshallah.
Yeah, but I think it's a wise decision.
We're looking forward to that.
Just to see how things go over the next couple of months, see how things pan out. It's a novel virus. We don't know how the vaccines, obviously, in a sense, with regards to long-term immunity. Yeah. So I think it's worthwhile just to see how things pan out. But inshallah, in the near future, we'll definitely work on something. The niyah's there and the himmah's there. So
absolutely. Inshallah. And me to hear that Jazza in person as well, inshallah.
And I'm sure you'll appreciate the holiday in Cape Town, eh? Just to
sightseeing. It's a beautiful place. Absolutely. And the food, bunny chow, all that stuff.
That's in Durban, I think.
All that stuff.
The Gatsby's.
Yeah, Kumbais, yeah. We ate there once.
What was it? The prawn. The prawn place. What was that? I can't remember. There was some place that had prawns.
It's in Joburg.
No, you know, that's in Joburg.
I think that was in Joburg, yeah. It was in Joburg.
But then, we also, there was a place.
Jomies.
There was this place in also in Johannesburg, but I remember this coffee shop called Motherland Coffee. And it had a drink called the Dictator. Make the day obey you. If any of you go to that coffee shop, take a picture of that drink, like on the menu. I somehow just stupidly didn't take a picture of it. It was the Dictator. Make the day obey you.
We'll try to arrange that as well.
Inshallah.
Dr. Rana, jazakumullah khairan.
Thank you.
Take care. Salam to your family. And we hope to have you on soon again. Thank you so much for your time.
See you later.
Okay.
Salaam alaikum.
Stay safe.
Shukran, everyone, for joining us. You know, it's quite late. We all have other things to do tomorrow, inshallah. But thank you so much. And shukran to Dr. Yusuf Patel for joining me as a co-host on this podcast. Ahlan wa sahlan. You're welcome anytime, inshallah.
Shukran.
Until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.